on the surface of the world.
Bomani.
All material products from earth, such as pots.
Bhutani,
which are produced.
Yata,
as.
Yanti,
appear in form.
Apayanti,
disappear.
Broken or mixed with the earth.
Cha,
and.
Na,
not.
I am Atma,
the soul or spiritual identity.
Tata,
similarly.
Eteshu,
among all these,
products of material elements.
Vipariyeti,
is changed or broken.
Yata,
as.
Eva,
certainly.
The earth.
Translation. In this world, we can see that pots, dolls, and other products of the earth appear, break, and then disappear, mixing with the earth. Similarly, the bodies of all conditioned living entities are annihilated, but the living entities, like the earth itself, are unchanging and never annihilated. Mahanyate, Hanyamane, Shirire. He read Bhagavad Gita. So, you repeat.
In this world,
we can see that pots, dolls,
and other products of the earth appear.
Break and then disappear.
Mixing with the earth.
Similarly, the bodies of all conditioned living entities
are annihilated.
But the living entities, like the earth itself,
are unchanging and never annihilated.
Nahanyate hanimane sharire.
So purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami,
Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Although Kamsa is described as a demon, he had good knowledge of the affairs of Atma Tattva, the truth of the self. 5,000 years ago, there were kings like Kamsa, who is described as an asura. But he was better than modern politicians and diplomats who have no knowledge about Atma Tattva. As stated in the Vedas, Asanga Yam Purusha, the spirit soul has no connection with the changes of the material body. The body undergoes six changes: birth, growth, sustenance, byproducts, dwindling, and then annihilation, but the soul undergoes no such changes. Even after the annihilation of a particular bodily form, the original source of the bodily elements does not change. The living entity enjoys the material body, which appears and disappears, but the five elements, earth, water, fire, air, and ether, remain the same. The example given here is that pots and dolls are produced from the earth, and when broken or destroyed, they mingle with their original ingredients. In any case, the source of supply remains the same. As already discussed, the body is made according to the desires of the soul. The soul desires, and thus the body is formed. Krishna therefore says in Bhagavad Gita, in the 18th chapter, text 61, Ishvara sarvabhutanam hridayeshe arjuna tishtati ramayan sarvabhutani yantra bhutani vaya. The Supreme Lord is situated in everyone's heart, O Arjuna, and is directing the wanderings of all living entities who are seated as on a machine made of the material energy. Neither the Supersoul, Paramatma, nor the individual soul changes its original spiritual identity. The Atma does not undergo birth, death, or changes like the body. Therefore, a Vedic aphorism says, Asanga Yam Purusha. Although the soul is conditioned within this material world, he has no connections with the changes of the material body. it again. Bhuvi bho mani bhutani yatha yantyapa yanticha mayum atma tathai teshu vipariyeti tathaiva bhu. So omagana timirandasya gananjana shalakaya chakshurun miritam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. There's several things going on here. I'd like to speak more about what's going on here psychologically than the ontology of the soul. What's going on here is that Kamsa, our friend, is trying to justify what he's done, first of all, and secondly, just to minimize the depravity, minimize the cruelty that he has just manifested. So there's two things going on. One is the justification. In this verse, he's minimizing the cruelty. Minimizing means he's just saying, you know, the body's temporary anyway, so if I end the body, it's just like breaking a doll. You know, it doesn't make any difference. You know, and of course, this is extremely unempathic, not compassionate in dealing with Devaki. You know. But anyway, so he's trying to diffuse the situation as far as his own guilt is concerned. Now, previously, in one of the previous verses, he is blaming providence. He's saying, alas, not only human beings, but sometimes providence lies. And I am so sinful that I believe the omen of providence. And I killed so many of my sister's children. So there's the underlying meaning here that he was justified in killing his own sister's children if providence had been right. In other words, he is invoking something called the law of survival. That if you're confronted with a particular situation and it's a question of you or someone else, then it may be all right to kill someone else. And of course, this is in philosophy, this is called an ethical dilemma. And he is not understanding this properly because it's a misuse of an ethical dilemma. Ethical dilemma means that you have some particular situation where it's not really clear which is the ethical or the correct decision to make. One of the standard examples they give in philosophy courses, I mean, it's a horrendous example. So there's a train, train that is going, I mean, there's several different versions of it, and then there's five people on the track that'll be run over by the train. I mean, what a horrible example. And you have a choice. The only way you can stop the train before it runs over the five people is that there's this big fat person you can push onto the tracks. Anyone's heard this before?
Not this version.
Yeah, there's different versions of the same thing, you know. One is that the train is going to fall off a cliff and you have to stop the train. This one is there's five people. Anyway, doesn't matter. It's the same thing. So the way you can stop the train is to push this big fat person somehow or other. He's big enough to stop the train. And he'll stop the train and save the five people. So what is the correct ethical thing to do? You know, they present, sometimes in these courses on ethics, they present these different dilemmas. And of course you have modern day dilemmas like, let's say a lady is pregnant and if she continues to carry the child, it'll most likely be the cause of her death. So therefore, should you kill the child? There's that particular dilemma. And that's a questionable thing. Of course, nowadays they have another ethical dilemma in which they err on the side of cruelty, which is on one side, you have the woman's right to have a free life without a kid, you know, make her own choice. That's, you know, an ethical dilemma. And on the other side, you have the child, which is going to interfere with her right to have her own life, you know, free life and everything like that. So which is more important? And of course, nowadays, they consider more important what? The right of a lady to make her own choices in life and do whatever she wants so she can be free, even if it means killing the child. And also, in order to justify that, they define life as when the child comes out of the womb and is able to survive on its own. And sometimes they even define life only if the child is not deformed. There's actually laws like that. Did you know that? It's interesting. There was a proposal in some state in the United States, and I forget the one right now, that the mother will have a right, or the doctor will have a right, to kill the deformed child. So you have these different types of dilemmas. Of course, they're misusing this dilemma to justify their own sense gratification, as Kamsa is doing too. But, you know, Kamsa does have an argument. And these sorts of dilemmas are actually very much prominent in the Vedic literatures too, where you have different ethical decisions to make, and a particular individual chooses one over another. I'll give you some examples. For example, you have Daksha's sons. He had two groups of sons, the Hariyashvas and the Savalashvas. The first group was 10,000 sons. Don't ask me how he had 10,000 sons, you know, but he did it. So they were approached by Narada Muni, and Narada Muni was preaching Krishna consciousness to them. Ultimately, he proved to them that their real father was Krishna. Because you don't want to do that with children. That would be very traumatic. I remember in the early days in the Gurukul, the children were crying, and they were crying, "Mommy, Mommy, Mommy," and then devotees preached, "Your real mother is Radharani, and your real father is Krishna. The rest of them are just illusions." So, I mean, there's certain circumstances where it's all right to preach. So Narada Muni was preaching that your real father is Krishna. And so they renounced everything and disobeyed their father's instruction. Now, for those of us in the Western world, disobeying your father's instruction is, you know, life, isn't it? You know, like Aditya Narayan Prabhu comes from a different culture where disobeying your father's instructions, like, never happened. I mean, if your father tells you, don't join the Hare Krishna movement, yes, yes, sir. But just like we have, you know, we have one devotee who's initiated for several years and he can't even tell his parents he's initiated or, you know, he's devoted to Krishna, because, you know, there's strong family connection. But anyway, let's go back to that Daksha example. That Daksha's sons disobeyed their father's instruction, which is a heavy thing in that culture. So they had a moral dilemma. You understand the moral dilemma? The ethical dilemma, sorry. Ethical dilemma. And they chose to obey Narada Muni rather than their father. And so we think they actually made the right choice. And, you know, it's actually a very interesting example. And then, on the other hand, another example of an ethical dilemma is you have the four Kumaras, the Chatushna, the four Kumaras. And the four Kumaras were the sons of Lord Brahma. And they were not preached to by Narada Muni, but I guess they were just self-realized because they were coming directly from Lord Brahma. And Lord Brahma, as their father, ordered them to get married. I mean, actually, they were only 5 years old, but in those days, they used to arrange marriages early. It's not that they would actually, like, live with their wives or something like that. Anyway, so they were ordered to get married, and they said, no, Dad, for a higher purpose. You know, so there's a dilemma there, you know, an ethical dilemma, like the higher purpose of life, even a spiritual dilemma. And And they said no, and Lord Brahma got very angry, and as a result, Lord Shiva popped out from, Rudra popped out from his forehead, and almost became the end of the universe. So there's another example of that. And then you have, I mean, there's so many examples of these types of dilemmas, and sometimes people make the right choices, sometimes they make the wrong choices, and sometimes they use them as an excuse for their activities, for their sinful activities, as Kamsa is doing right here. Another example that comes to mind is Grandfather Bhishma. Grandfather Bhishma had taken a vow to support whoever was the king of Hastinapur, to never get married, etc. And what happened is that he was confronted with this dilemma where the person who he was supporting was not ethical, you know, was immoral, was Duryodhana. And so what was he to do in that circumstance? So he made the wrong choice. He chose to follow the ethics of keeping your word rather than doing what was best for humanity. Very interesting. And, of course, in Bhagavad Gita, we have another dilemma like that. Arjuna is presented with a dilemma. And, you know, if he fights, he's going to be killing his cousins, he's going to be killing his teacher, he's going to be killing his grandfather. I mean, what a dilemma. And on the other hand, you know, Krishna's giving him an instruction. So he became very bewildered and confused and even frightened at that particular juncture. So he, you know, he was confronted with that, and finally, by the good instructions of Krishna, he was able to make the right decision. So we find in the name of these dilemmas, people doing so many horrendous activities. Not only, like I said, sometimes they make the right decision, sometimes they make the wrong decision. Even Hitler justified his particular activities by a higher principle. What was his higher principle? It's called eugenics. Eugenics means breeding people, you know, breeding or coming up, allowing. This is actually one of the problems with Darwin's theory of evolution. He justified his activities by Darwin's theory of evolution. He's just going to make evolution act a little quicker rather than through natural selection. It's going to be through intelligent design, which is actually interesting. But he wasn't so intelligent. So anyway, the main point I'm making here is that Kamsa is just looking for a way to avoid responsibility for his actions and blame his actions on something else or on his own moral choice to stay alive. So another point here is that what Prabhupada is talking about in the purport is the eternality of the soul and the fact that demons 5,000 years ago actually had spiritual knowledge and they understood. The only problem that they had was that they were demons in the sense that they were against Krishna. They were against God. That's the only problem. Otherwise, they were quite educated, and Prabhupada comments that the modern politicians and diplomats have no knowledge about Atma-Tattva, and therefore they're less than demons. They were just like animals. So anyway, so that's all I wanted to speak about today. So any questions or comments? Yes, just a group.
Play a bit of a devil's advocate here. How is it possible for Bhishma to make a wrong choice as a Mahajan?
That's actually a very interesting question. Bhishma as a Mahajan, some people say, there's two ways that people answer that question, because I've actually researched it. One is that he became a Mahajan after understanding how he had made that mistake of the ethical dilemma. In fact, at the when he's lying on the bed of arrows after the battle of Kurukshetra, he admits that it was a mistake. And he, one of the main topics in the Mahabharata is the topic of morality. You know, what is moral? Is morality determined by the act itself or the consequences of the act, which is called consequentialism? So he admits at the end of the Gita, while he's lying at the end of the Mahabharata, while he's lying on the bed of arrows, that morality is determined by the consequences of an action. And he gives this very interesting example, which we've given many times before. He said, once upon a time, there were a bunch of dacoits that were running after a family. The family took shelter in the ashram of some saint. The dacoits went to the saint and said, "Where's the family?" And the saint said, "They're here," and they were killed as a result of that. And so the saint was responsible for that, and he made the wrong ethical decision. And Grandfather Bhishma admits that. So one version is that he actually realized things at the end and became a Mahajan. Another version is that it was passed on to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and he was under the Yogamaya potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead to enact a particular pastime, because the Lord wanted to destroy all the demoniac forces that had taken shelter on the earth planet. And these were demons mentioned in the eighth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam who took birth on the earth planet to conduct their nefarious activities. So Bhishma was part of that whole dramatic performance. In fact, even in the Mahabharata, it mentions that Duryodhana was Kali, a demigod, you know, Kali the demigod, who was put there to create the strife or the friction so that these demons could be killed. And Shakuni was Dwarpar, another demigod, you know, in charge of the age of Dwarpar. So they had a part to play. So that's another explanation for that, why Grandfather Bhishma made the wrong decision. But we are continually confronted with these ethical decisions, I mean, in so many different ways. I mean, when we joined the Hare Krishna movement, you know, I was told, come back, you know, you're killing your mother. I always give that example. I got the message from my mother that she was dying because I joined the Hare Krishna movement. And I just made the decision not to kill my mother. I made the decision to serve Krishna because I had a higher purpose in life. And she's still alive after all these years. And I'm going to see her tomorrow. But anyway. So, you know, that's definitely an ethical decision. We have personal ethical decisions to make. Like, I mean, I hate to give this personal example, but it's just like people ask, you know, why I don't drink milk. Because that's an ethical decision. I'm not saying that I'm right. I'm not saying that someone else is wrong. You know, people sometimes throw philosophy at you. And they say, you know, Prabhupada said this, Prabhupada said that. The more cows that are, the more milk you get, the more cows that will be there. Even if they're killed, they'll get benefits. Or, they'll take human bodies in the next life. I mean, there's justifications for particular moral, ethical positions. I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm not making a judgment right now. But I'm just saying that people will say that on that side. And I'll say on my side, that's my ethical decision. And people have to respect those ethical decisions too. As long as they're not something like what Kamsa is doing here. You know, saying, you know, I'm going to kill all the kids born of my sister to protect my life. But there are definite ethical decisions each and every one of us has to make. And it's not carved in stone what we should do in each particular circumstance. And that's up to the individual. The individual has to develop, doesn't have to, but should develop a moral compass so they can make these decisions properly. Now, that's the main problem with Kamsa. He hasn't developed that moral compass, or at least it's the compass, like they say.
He's pointing in the wrong direction.
He's pointing, pointing in the wrong direction. Not only that, just like they say, the magnetic north pole is shifting now. So his compass keeps shifting. So it's important for us to be ethical. So, you know, we may be confronted with a situation like this. That, you know, this... I mean, let's give an example. Okay, here's a perfect example from the Mahabharata. That you have Dronacharya. And he knew that Dhrishtadyumna was supposed to kill him, right? Dhrishtadyumna was the son of Drupada. Drupada did this fire sacrifice and to have someone who would kill Dronacharya because he was really angry at Dronacharya. Dronacharya had taken away half of his kingdom because he had defeated him utilizing the Pandavas. Okay, so Dhrishtadyumna comes out of the fire. And of course, Draupadi comes out of the fire too. So what happens is that Drona actually trains up Dhrishtadyumna. You know, there's an ethical decision, you know, he made. Should I kill him? Why should I train him? But he understood that, you know, this is the Dharma. Even if he's supposed to kill me, I will still train him up. So here's someone who made a completely different decision than Kamsa made. Because he was, you know, ethical, more ethical. I mean, I don't want to criticize his ethics. Obviously, he did a lot of things wrong, too. He fought on the wrong side. I mean, Drona fought on the wrong side. It's described because he was... Actually, Prabhupada said because he was eating food cooked in the kitchen of Duryodhana's kitchen. Duryodhana wasn't the cook, but it was obviously the food was probably pretty impure. His mind became wicked. So that's another point. You know, if you don't keep your mind pure, you won't make the right decision. So he made the wrong decision to fight on the wrong side, but he made the right decision. You know, I'm just putting a judgment on it. He made the right decision to not kill Dhrishtadyumna. So it's interesting. This is before his mind became contaminated. So you need to have your mind in the mode of goodness. So that means, as they say in Buddhism, right living, right thinking, right, you know, what we say, right eating. So that you can make the right decisions. Because what Kamsa, I mean, from a particular individual's perspective, Kamsa's actions might be understandable. Here is someone who is going to kill you. You have faith in a providence, right? You know, so Ocris Kamsa's usually as an excuse. But here's someone who's going to kill you. What is your, you know, like the, here's the child in the womb who's going to kill you, right? If you allow the child to grow, or the embryo, sorry, to grow. So what do you do? So Kamsa made a decision here. One can look at it from that particular perspective. So that's why it's important to have a good moral compass. So you can make the right decisions at the right time and be responsible for your moral actions. We are moral actors. So, Gopi, you had a question?
Yeah, I mean, I think you somewhat answered it.
What?
Just in the context of, you know, my mind, of course, is thinking as a devotee, what tools, you know, and you've talked about it, the mode of goodness, like bringing ourselves to the mode of goodness. You know, what can we do to make the right decision? Help.
Well, you have to, didati prati grunati, guyamakyati prichati. Here's another example, a practical example with Prabhupada. One time a devotee wrote Prabhupada, and the devotee said, the doctors have prescribed this medicine that has animal products in it. So there's Prabhupada. Should you take it? Should I take it? And Prabhupada said, if the doctor said that without it, you're going to become very sick and die, you should take it. You know, there's a decision, an ethical, moral decision. Another thing, you know, see, even practically, let's say, we follow the four regular principles. And certainly, we don't smoke marijuana. At least I don't. But if someone has a disease, terminal cancer or something like that, are they breaking the regulative principles? You know, there's all sorts of decisions you got to make in life like this. You know, life is not so simple. That's the point I'm making. Another example is, you know, so someone takes a promise, makes a vow to chant 16 rounds a day. Okay. Then let's say they're in a situation, they have a child, a little baby that's just like screaming all day long, as they do. A mother, we're talking about the mother. Then what do you do? Do you just like throw the child away, or, you know, just lock the child up in, you know, chains or something on the crib? Let the child scream all day long? You know, so you have a decision to make. And sometimes you may not. There's certain circumstances where someone may not be able to chant 16 rounds for a particular purpose. It's called extenuating circumstances. So you have decisions to make in those circumstances. I mean, some people are able to continue to chant 16 rounds of having 20 babies. And some people are not. You know, or let's say we had a devotee who was recently in the boot camp. Boot camp doesn't mean you wear boots. He was in this place called Paris Island. And they had marine training. And so, you know, you generally need 2 hours to chant your rounds every day. So what could he do? Could he tell his trainer what?
Drill sergeant.
I need 2 hours to chant my rounds. You know, this guy, a guy was yelling at him, yelling at his, one of his friends, just for wearing a cross. But anyway. So it's an extenuating circumstance. You have to balance things in life. You really have to balance things. So it's important to develop that moral compass. I mean, that's one thing is if you just become attached to certain rules and regulations, you know, they don't fit every circumstance. You have to be able to discriminate. Prabhupada said discrimination is the better part of valor. Yeah, Purvaji.
I had a question about Hitler. One is, I know Prabhupada said a few things about dialogue, with my second question. I'm trying to understand how a whole country bought into his conception of killing a whole race.
Which whole country are you talking about?
Germany.
Oh, Germany!
Yeah,
well, that's because you use that, you know, the master race thing. And, you know, there's also herd mentality and psychological factors, which I don't have time to get into right now. It's not that a whole country. Many people were opposed. Many people followed because they were frightened. But there is a certain herd mentality. There's been psychologists and sociologists who study this when people snap into a certain thing. I know someone who was part of that. He's a father of one of my devotees, and his father just snapped into it. And after it was all over, he just said, "What did I do?" You know, there's like a herd mentality too, in which one sacrifices their ethical. This is an important point you just brought up, because I've seen that happen within ISKCON or within any organization, that people give up because someone else is making the decisions for them. So people relinquish their own moral compass and don't take responsibility for their actions. Here's Kamsa, not taking responsibilities for his actions. So I've seen that happen on an institutional basis too. And people don't take responsibility for that. What? Yeah, I'm not going to mention any places. It's happened in communities where people don't take responsibility over their judgment. I mean, in New York, for example, this is a practical example. The temple president's wife was offering eggs to the deities, and nobody reported to Prabhupada.
Yeah.
You know, so Hare Krishna.